Welcome back, team. I just want you to know Bart Sego, our community pastor for Bentonville, came up to just critique the material. He clearly says, hey, that USA Today poll, it could not be true. It has to be fake news. And he knows it's fake news, he said, because there couldn't have been just one answer what to watch on TV. He said, first of all, it's way more complex. It's what's the DVR? What to Netflix? Who gets the remote? That is total fake news, and you cannot buy stuff like that. You need to research more thoroughly, Mark. I think he's got a point. I think he has a point. Come on in. We'll jump in together. It'll be, what session did you say it's in the book, Aaron?
Session four.
Well, let's keep the story going. Remember, this story of Adam and Eve is actually our story. God chose to show off in us. He actually said, I want mankind and womankind to look like me, to act like me on planet Earth. And so he brings us together in this relationship of promise. By the way, in a relationship of promise, we call that a covenant. And he starts to live out in this covenant, the man does, the more of the strength of God through his impact. And she lives out more of the mercy of God through the way she connects. They are equal but distinct. Something, though, happened to that picture of marriage, right? The rock hits the pond in that first picture of marriage, and the ripple effects start to distort the image. We see that in the fall, that man moves to a place where he moves, instead of initiative, to passivity, instead of caring, to times where he can become more dominant. What about woman, though? What effects of the fall happen to the feminine soul and the feminine identity? You know, if you listen to most Christian marriage teaching, most preachers, most teachers will camp on and talk mostly about the man, won't they? Have you ever wondered why that is? I mean, we just don't tend to deal much with the fall of woman. I wonder if that's because most preachers, most teachers are men, and they just won't want to go there. It's awkward. But at the same time, you see it over and over. I mean, Mother's Day and Father's Day messages coming up. Every Mother's Day, the sermon is going to sound something like, women, you're just fantastic. Thank you. And the Boy Scouts are in the lobby, and they've got a carnation you can buy because we just want you to have that. And then you turn around a few weeks later, and there's a Father's Day message. Guys, does it sound that way? No, it usually sounds so different. It sounds kind of like, man, you're the problem. And nobody's out in the foyer with power tools that you can buy, right? They have nothing for you. We just need you to pick up your game and quit ruining this thing for us. And so we act like over and over again, most Christian teaching is dumbed down on marriage to say, well, the man is the problem. Well, guys, when we're open and honest with each other, we know we're a problem, right? But we know that can't be the whole story. And I think when we present the story that way, we actually do more damage to women than men. Most women that I know that there's a problem with that approach. A number of years ago, in fact, you can tell by even the way the next slide looks so old and faded when it was scanned in. It's probably more than 20 years ago. Lisa came to me with a cartoon that she cut out of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette that morning. The cartoon is from the cartoon, I don't even know if it's still around, called Jumpstart. And this is what it says. Two women are talking in a bookstore, and a customer says to the clerk, my marriage could use some improvement. Do you have any books on the subject? And the female clerk says, we have a ton, right this way. And then the clerk says, these books are specifically written to help women become better wives. And the customer says, I thought you said you had a ton. I only see about 5 books here. And the last frame is the clerk saying, this way to the How to Be a Better Husband wing. And that is almost the cliche that we replay over and over again when we talk about marriage in our culture. I think the problem is twofold, though. Number one, I don't think it's honest. And I think most women know it's not honest. Again, she knows that she's married a man who's a son of Adam, but she looks in the mirror and she sees a daughter of Eve, too, and she wonders, why is it that I tick the way I tick, and why is it that I get ticked off the way I get ticked off? The second problem is I don't think it's honoring to women. The good and strong women that I know, they get tired of feeling patronized, as though we won't talk talked about the truth with them, and we talk around it or over it or under it, and after a while they're saying, really, I'm a big girl. I can handle the truth. Can we talk about it? And so let's go there. Let's look at the curse's effect on women and how it plays out in a marriage. You see, Genesis chapter 3, verse 16. There's only one verse that God says to Eve, and it's a doozy. He says, to the woman, he said, I will greatly multiply your pain in childbirth. In pain you will bring forth children, yet your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. Now don't forget, how was woman created? Primarily, she was created to what? To connect, right? What is the very thing that God chooses to curse in her life? Her ability to connect. Relationships are the primary way she displays her glory, not the only way. Particularly, though, important to her are her relationship with her husband and her children. What are the very two things God touches in the curse? Her relationship to her husband and her children. Genesis 2, woman has been created to complete her husband. He cannot do this job of ruling creation without her. God says something about her relationship with her husband in this verse. Genesis 3, she's named Eve because she is the mother of all living things. God says something about her relationship with her kids in this verse. First thing you say in this curse is what? Pain in childbirth. So the whole reproductive cycle has been cursed with pain, right? The whole monthly cycle that a woman walks through reminds her of this curse. I grew up with three brothers. All of us were 18 months apart. There were four boys in this rough, rowdy, locker room kind of crowd. Lisa and I got married in college. We were married young. I never lived with sisters. I didn't have any idea just even how the impact of that cycle would happen in our relationship. I remember us early in our marriage, Lisa came out of into the kitchen and was like, oh, I just feel like this is that time where my skin is crawling. And I said, what's that mean? She goes, I have PMS. And I go, well, more importantly, what's that mean for me? I mean, I don't mean to make it all about me, but what does that mean for me? And she looked at me and said, that means we're going to fight. You pick the topic. And there was this sense of, okay, something is really happening that is real. It's not made up. It's more than cliche. But then there's even pain obviously associated in childbirth, and I've got nothing to say about that at the risk of offending at least half of you. But even there's pain in even conceiving a child. 15% of all couples in the United States cannot conceive or bring a child to full term. All of the realities of childbirth remind us of the curse. But God chooses not to stop there. You talk to most women and you say, what is the curse in Genesis 3 towards a woman? And she will say quickly, pain in childbirth. And so it is. But there is no period after that. There's a comma that moves to another set of relationships in her life. The relationship with her husband. We're going to talk more about that in just a second. But because of this ability to connect, this way a woman has been wired to showcase the glory of God through her relational ability, and because of the fact that the curse has touched that relational ability, a woman also carries a great fear. Just like men have a greatest fear that touches our soul, a woman does as well. And I would phrase that as the fear of loneliness. Loneliness. Just like a man's impact was blunted, her connection will now be impaired. And therefore, her greatest fear of loneliness begins to show up. It also has a question that rumbles around like white noise in the back of her mind all the time. It sounds a little bit like a man's, am I enough? But it has a little different nuance. And it sounds more like this. Am I delightful? Am I really delightful? And when I say delightful, I'm not talking about just physical beauty, although that's an aspect. Because to reduce the aspect of a woman's feminine power and glory and strength just to physical beauty, I think that's been done far too much in our culture. I think that when a woman is asking that, she's saying, when someone sees me, do they see the power of my mind? Do they see the tenderness of my heart? Do they see the strength of my soul? Do they delight in what I bring to the table here? Am I delightful in all that I bring as a woman, soul, spirit, mind, and yes, even her physical beauty, her body? I had an appointment a couple of weeks ago, a meeting with a woman in our church body who is she's a woman of influence. She has tens of thousands of women who read her blog every week. And at one point I looked at her and I said, "Hey, Holly, I'm doing this thing in a couple of weeks with some couples in Fayetteville, and I wonder, when you talk to all of these women and they chatter back to you in comment sections of blog posts, Holly, what is the number one thing that you continue to hear?" And she said, "I think it can be summed up this way. Women are asking, am I invisible?" I think it's that same manifestation of that question, that fear that somehow I'll be left out of this thing, I'll be left alone, I won't be delighted for in all that I bring. You see, 1 Corinthians 11, Paul says, woman is the glory of man. What does that mean? Well, we know that one aspect of glory means to delight, right? We glory in God because we delight in who He is. And women know that they want to be cherished that way. In the same way, when Eve was created by God and the Father brings His prized creation to this man, to this son, and presents her, Adam responds with utter delight. The English says in our Bibles, he says, "This at last." Well, actually, the Hebrew, we translate it that way because we don't really have a word. And for the Hebrew, it's really a sigh. It's kind of like this, at last. And there's delight, bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. She's like me, but she's not me. I delight in her. And indeed, that sense of am I delightful does not stop after the garden story ends in a fall. In fact, I think it gets amplified even more. I heard a woman married more than 25 years say of her husband, "I have always known my husband was a good man and committed to me. But in this season of our marriage, I actually believe he prefers me too." What she's saying is, this man delights in me, and he's answered my question. One of my mentors and an early boss of mine, who writes a lot on the area of marriage and parenting, he once told me of a conversation that he had with his wife, where his wife looked at him and said, "I know you love me, and you show your unconditional love to me really well, but sometimes I need to know, do you want to love me?" What was she saying? Am I still delightful? See, men, I wonder if our wives think that as Christian men, we love them because we have to. After all, in the 90s, we went to a Promise Keepers rally. It was one of our 7 promises, and by golly, I'm gonna keep it. I said, "I love you, and I'm gonna be just committed to you," and you grit your teeth and you plow through the commitment, and somehow it doesn't do much for her. Interestingly enough, when the Bible talks about a husband's love to the wife, it assumes committed. It never says committed. It's almost like the Bible saying, duh, you're going to be committed, but the word it uses is, will you cherish her? Why? Because God's answering the question that's deeper down, am I delightful, and that fear of loneliness. The curse on Eve tells us one reason why that fear of loneliness is so strong in marriage. Look at 3:16 again. "To the woman, God said, I'll greatly multiply your pain in childbirth. In pain, you'll bring forth children." Semicolon, and here's the aspect on marriage. "Yet your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you." And oh my, do I wish the word desire meant what I want it to mean. I want it to mean, this is a promise that Lisa will be always warm for my form. That's just, she can't help it. I mean, she just can't help it. Right, Lisa? And she says, this is the very reason I'm sitting on the back row. Because you lose your filter sometimes, Mark. But it doesn't mean that. The word desire doesn't mean warm for your form, guys. It means she's hot after your job, okay? It's a total different word. The next time that the Bible uses the word desire comes up in the next chapter in Genesis. Genesis chapter 4, verse 6. Again, we looked at that last night when we talked about resolving conflict and how to deal with anger. But there he says to Cain, Cain, sin is crouching at the door and its desire is for you. What does sin want to do? It wants to overtake you. Same exact Hebrew word for desire. The word desire, it means to absorb. It means to consume. It means to control. Kylan Delitzsch, the famous Old Testament scholars from a previous two generations ago, they say that the word desire means overtake. Your desire, wives, will be to overtake. Your appetites will be to somehow be competitive with him and the leadership of that marriage. It tells us something. It tells us that Eve, she lives out her fall very uniquely from her husband, that she who was created to respond and to follow that man will now move to a place where she's tries to control and be independent from him. And you see the circles played out there so differently in her life, where she now moves to control and independence. You see independence quickly in the way they run from each other, make fig leaves and hide. But you see overtaking, or that sense of control, in God's curse in verse 16. Your desire will be for your husband. You're going to want his headship. There's going to be a competition set up in the marriage. You now no longer want to complete him and compliment him. You're just going to want to make sure he does things your way. Now, I didn't say that all women are controlling. That's such a sweeping generalization. You don't appreciate that any more than I do. Men don't like to be heard that we're always only passive. That's not true. That's a sweeping generalization. But every woman struggles with pockets of control or independence. One of my wife's favorite movies is Big Fat Greek Wedding. She still will quote sometimes that little scene that sometimes is often quoted. Yes? The man may be the head, but the woman is the neck. And she can turn the head any way she wants. And it's art imitating the truth of life. Control comes in lots of different packages. Sometimes it actually comes in a soft, tender kind of package. On the soft side, maybe some women can always portray themselves as a little girl, and you find some women, have you noticed this, particularly some younger women, even through adolescence or early 20s, where they always seem to need a man. They always just seem to be super needy, almost codependent. So they move from relationship to relationship quickly. That's actually a control tactic. I'm not going to be hurt. I'm going to control this relationship. Or maybe later, she has the soft side of a gracious hostess. She's always going to be dutiful and busy and nice and retreating and just a little too aloof to kind of engage here. It has a harder side too, though, doesn't it? I mean, the book of Proverbs says the hard side can come up as the seductress who uses her physical beauty as a control tactic. By the way, that's super prevalent right now in our culture. I'm going to print all the labels of my clothing on my backside so that I will get a man to notice me, notice me, notice me. It can also come across on the hardest side as the angry liberationist. Either way, it's a way of saying, I will control the temperature of this relationship with a man. When this was first dawning on me about the Genesis 3, 1, 2, and 3 issues of the fall, Lisa said, hey, I'm leading this group of about 25 women in the morning. Would you do a little thing on Genesis 3 and the fall that touches a woman's soul? And I'm like, are you kidding me? And so I go in there and I'm really meekly kind of putting this out there. It means control if you think so, you know, and I'm handling it like a real man, right? I'm passively backing away from the table. And then immediately the women in her group, and she had so many sharp women in there who started jumping on it. And so I made the comment, I said, where do you see this show up? Because it doesn't look in all these cliche, stereotypical packages. Sometimes it might be the why driving a what in your marriage. Where do you see it? And women started jumping in like super honest. Oh, I use nagging. I know how to start it soft, and I can even get the right tone to get it to move into him, to move into action. Another woman said, oh, nagging doesn't work for me. Sometimes I find sex is better. He's just more agreeable if there's a prospect of sex. And I'm like, well, okay, this is too honest. Now, here's the deal. They weren't saying I'm consciously manipulating my husband. I think most of us can see that there's evil just on the table there. But they were saying, I get it that I have power as a woman. And I find myself, you're right, I can kind of default to using that power to get my way in this relationship. A few months later, I was asked at another church in town, a very large church in town, to teach this to a group of women on a morning seminar. It was like 250 women in there. I was the only guy in the room. It was so uncomfortable. I was so nervous and so scared. And so I get up there and I kind of squeak, you know, my voice is cracking, and I go through the whole thing. And then they're going to go to small groups, and I bolt to go back to my office across town. I do my days of appointments, and I'm checking voicemail before going home, and I return a phone call and listen to this voicemail, this very sweet, kind voice saying, Mark, I was at your thing this morning. I really appreciate it. I've got a question or two to help me clarify. Could you give me a call at your convenience? And I thought, I'll call her before I head home. So I dialed the number back at my office, and she said, Mark, I just want to thank you, and what a blessing, just a super sweet southern voice, what a blessing, what an encouragement. But you know, our pastor has taught us not to build a whole doctrine on one word of the scripture. Now, I might have been born at night, but it wasn't last night. I'm hearing a railroad train coming, okay? And I'm like, that's because you have a really wise pastor. You said you had a question. What would your question be? Well, see, that's just it. I think you're building this whole thing and this whole model about control based on this one word, desire, and I just don't think that's a fair treatment of what desire means. And I said, boy, I could be wrong. I have actually been wrong before. What do you think desire means? And she said, well, I think that means we're going to be attracted to our husbands. And I said, now, don't forget, this is a curse to Eve. I don't know what your husband looks like, but exactly how is that a curse to you that you're going to be attracted to your man? That feels kind of like a blessing, not a curse. And it's just me. I'm looking at Genesis 3. It's like a curse. And she goes, I don't know. I just know it doesn't mean control. And I said, okay, what is the curse for woman? And she said, well, pain in childbirth. And I said, great. So if Eve just chooses to not have children, she can kind of outfox God and miss out on the curse. So what would the curse be, and what would this thing desire be? Because it's sitting in our text. We got to do something with it. And she goes, I don't know. I just know it doesn't mean control, and you can't build that whole thing off this word. I know it doesn't. And I'm sitting there going, we don't even know each other. And I say, okay, I appreciate your thoughts. I really do. Thank you. I'll do some more thinking on it on my end. Why don't you do some more thinking on it your end, and we'll just go from there. Goodbye. Have a great day. And I hang up the phone. As I'm driving home, it occurs to me, I just spent 22 minutes on the phone with a woman who was trying to control me into believing that this verse doesn't mean control, and she's not even married to me. We'll never see each other again until the other side of glory. But somehow I represented male authority, and she needed me to know that it could not mean this. Women, we need to realize that there's lots of ways that control can play out in a marriage. The Proverbs talk about it over and over again in ways that we never talk about in church. In Proverbs, early part of the book, it says the seductress uses her beauty to control a man. Later in the book, it says there's a contentious wife. Contentious doesn't mean bad wife. It just means a wife who's contending or battling her husband. And she's using nagging. In both cases, the writer says to this young man, to this son, listen, it's better for you to get out of there. Look, my favorite verse that's used in the Proverbs to the church, but also into marriage, is Proverbs 27:17. As iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. Is that not a cool passage for a married couple? We sharpen each other. I have never once heard a sermon on the full context of that verse. The previous two verses say this, Proverbs 27, verse 15. A constant dripping on a day of steady rain and a contentious woman are alike. I'm not going there. You're not hearing a sermon on that at Mosaic. He who would restrain her restrains the wind and grasps oil with his right hand. You know, Solomon is coaching his son. He says next, he says in chapter 21, listen, son, I just need you to know about married life. It's going to be better for you to live on the corner of a roof than in a house shared with a contentious woman. And then for some reason later, 10 verses later, Solomon changes his mind. He goes, no, actually, son, if you're on the corner of your roof, you could still hear her. So what I want you to do, I want you to live in a desert land. That would be better. Better than a desert land than live with a contentious and vexing woman. In other words, buddy, you're going to have every part of you that's just going to want to bolt. And women, you see your husband do that. We do it. I just work in the garage and piddle around out there. Work on the computer and piddle around over there because I can't go there with you right now. Or I'm going to take more business travel or extend those trips as long as I can. I just want to create some desert land space between us because it's just too hard. 1 Peter 3 is, I think, my wife's claim to fame. I really do. It talks about a pure beauty, a true beauty that's of a woman that's her quiet and gentle spirit. I love the way Lisa teaches this to women. She says, quiet does not mean doormat, and it does not mean silent. For God gave us to our husbands to our voice to be heard and to speak that voice. But how we speak it is everything. Quiet and gentle spirit can actually be translated cool and calm spirit. You're not controlling, you're not battling, you're not going after him. You just want to come along and complete him rather than compete with him. So do you live out your glory by completing your man or competing with him? You know, all couples have some degree of a cycle between male passivity and female control. All of us do. The issue is, are we stuck in the cycle? You see, just like there's a life cycle, there's actually a vicious cycle. And I can't tell you if a passive man produces a controlling woman. I think it does. But I also can't tell you if a controlling woman produces a passive man. I think it does. So which came first, the chicken or the egg? All I know is most couples will argue about it in their kitchen until 2 in the morning. Instead of just saying, we have a chicken and we have an egg, and I gotta own which one I am. We tend to say things like, she gets angry and says, someone's got to step up here and initiate. And he says, well, I might if you'd let me. No, you never do. And I don't know that there's any good way out of that dialogue other than to know that there is a cycle. And we can be trapped in that. And some of you know exactly what I mean. There's some wives here, maybe some husbands, where you've been focusing across the diagram to the other circle you're married to. So long that you're convinced, if they just change, then I could change. But the cool thing is you only have to say grace over one person. God's only put one person on the planet for you to be responsible for. And it's you. And so you begin to say, Lord, how am I living? Am I being controlling here, or am I complimenting him and completing him in a way that empowers him? And men, same way for us. Women, let's shoot straight, just since we're talking specifically to unwives this time. Yes, your man is too passive. Good luck finding one of us that doesn't struggle with that. But trying to fix him and control him, it's not working, is it? In fact, in some ways, that's a little bit of the control tactic. As a pastor, I find a couple that's stuck in a vicious cycle, one of the worst things that happens to that wife is when he finally wakes up and starts walking like God's man. She loves it, and then it starts to expose her deficiencies. And she doesn't like it, because now the relationship has a new equilibrium, and we can no longer continue with the myth that he is all the problem. See, even assuming that the man is all the problem is a control tactic. Anybody else want to acknowledge in the room, I'm the problem? I am the person who needs to grow and to change. Years ago, Lisa and I used to use a word picture in our marriage to help us understand this unique thing that happened in conflict in marriage. I don't know that we've used it for decades or so now, but early on we'd said, it feels like we're having a sword fight when we had conflict. It feels like a sword fight, like two people clashing swords. I think this, know this. You said first, no, then you. And then we started thinking, it's not a sword fight, it's a fight over the same sword. God only gave one sword to a husband and wife, just one. And he told them to embrace that as a team. And they're going to rule all of the creation he gave them to rule over, whatever your corner of the world is. And he put that sword in a man's hand, and he can't pick that up and rule and reign like God wants him to rule and reign unless she comes along as a helper and picks it up with him and they use it together. So when we think we're having a sword fight, we're really fighting over the same sword. In passivity, I'm stepping away. And in control, she's picking it up. And now we've had to just say, let's put this thing down and reapproach it differently together. Well, I will initiate. And she says, and I'll be on your team and help complete you in that. Do you have any of those individuals in your life that retire and then they go home? Especially men tend to do this. And then they send and forward you email full-time for the rest of your life. Have any people in your life like that? I have a couple of guys like that. They used to work 60 hours a week. Now they forward email for 50 hours a week. This showed up in my inbox one day. The subject line was marriage in the animal kingdom. In the text of the email was this picture. That's creepy and offensive and bothersome because it can be slightly true, right? It represents a visual of the vicious cycle. You know, oddly enough, women, most of us as men are slightly afraid of you. I mean that in the best and healthiest way, meaning we're really quite awestruck by you. I mean, to reject the level of passivity we had to reject to actually pick up the phone and call you for a date for the first time, and then to initiate all the other ways of relationship that actually got you to think that you could actually spend like a lifetime with us, we're in awe of you. And we know the second we're married to you, you will see us as we truly are, and we're now exposed. And so we're also kind of frightened by the power that you have in our lives. And I know you see the same way, life the same way, and the power that's of being exposed in front of your husband. We need to realize that the vicious cycle is not healthy and helpful. In fact, we can pull that picture down now because it's just offensive. And the Proverbs tell us better news. Proverbs 18 says, he who finds a wife finds what? A good thing. You know that? And then it says, and obtains favor from the Lord. You know what that word favor means? Grace. I didn't get a wife. How arrogant is that? God gave me a wife. Wives, you didn't just get a husband. God gave you a husband. There's a grace to this human being that God gave you, even in your hardest situations. He who finds a wife finds a good thing and finds favor from the Lord. And that favor comes when a woman walks away from her fallenness and lives out her created design. For 30 years, I've been telling Lisa, she brings more color, more texture, more beauty to my life than I could ever imagine. It's not a snow job. It's not a sales job. I actually believe that because there's a favor and a goodness of God that comes. The curse, yeah, it's still our reality. The Schatzman household looks a little too much like a man who struggles with passivity and a woman who struggles with control, and occasionally they get tangled up. But that is not the only reality. The other reality is this good news of the gospel that moves us from a vicious cycle to a life cycle. And we're going to talk about that after the break. For now, what do we do when we see Genesis 3 reality of a man and a woman sitting in front of us? It'd be easy to despair, wouldn't it? Instead, I don't think we need to despair. I think we do need to embrace the reality that we see, that we are broken, flawed people married to each other. That reality will actually do two things. Number one, it'll keep us humble. Number two, it'll keep us realizing we need each other. But not only embrace the reality, I think we need to embrace the vision that God sees, because God doesn't ever see us just as we are. God sees us as who he's making us to be. And for that to happen, we're going to need the next set of circles, which we'll talk about right after the break.